I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
We'll just see.
Oh, I gotcha. I can hear you now.
Ah, good. Okay.
Okay, I think maybe the magic has happened, finally.
Great.
Oh, my gosh. So, okay. Probably like kind of the opposite experience you had in a professional environment at Midtake Connection. Probably.
You would be surprised.
Yeah, I guess technical difficulties can happen whether you have fantastic equipment or, you know, your ancient computer trying to chuck away at it.
That's right. And the more complex the equipment, the harder it is to diagnose. So.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Oh gosh. So what was like the worst fiasco you can remember as far as like technical difficulties?
Oh, well, the first one that comes to mind was my fault, and this was really early in my radio career. I was filling in producing on a program, and I'm a fidgeter when I sit in a chair, and so I had my legs crossed, and I was just like bobbing my foot, you know, my leg, and I'm just like, and all of a sudden, the whole program went off air, like the whole station went off air, like everything was just dead. And so all the engineers are scrambling and I'm sitting there like, I have no idea what happened. Obviously I did nothing because I'm just sitting here in my producer's station. And then it turns out I had found with my foot, my bobbing foot, the one computer that was, this was really early in broadcasting, at least my broadcasting career. So it's like, it was, I don't know, it was just kind of moving over to full computer, stuff. And so my toe had hit the power button on a computer that was under my station. Shut everything down. And so, surprise, surprise, they moved that computer to another place.
Yeah, it was right there by your foot. So what are you supposed to do, right?
Right, exactly. But, you know, it took a while to figure that out because, you know, that's supposed to be really safe. That's out of the way. It's under the desk.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yeah, I turned it off. So ever since then, I was really paranoid about touching any sort of computer with my foot or
And as a producer, what does your job entail?
Well, it's different for different programs, but for mostly what I did with Midday and what I have done mostly in radio is a lot of behind the scenes stuff like booking programs and coming up with ideas and website and, you know, social media and stuff. But then during the actual program, you're there to be another set of eyes and ears to direct the program, to bring in elements that would enhance the content that's being talked about right at that moment, to quickly look stuff up. If the host is stuck on some fact, the producer can quickly just like look it up and then message them with the information or talk in their ear. Or if there's a question that people, like as a producer or the engineer or, you know, other people that are in the control room, if they're like, wait, what? What did that or what did the guest mean? Then the producer can just be like, "Ooh, can you clarify that? You know, that seemed a little unclear to us." Or, it's like the producer is kind of like a safety to make the whole program run well, sound good, be clear, and all that stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it sounds like you have to be very quick on your feet and flexible to like. It's not a. Is that the kind of thing that stresses you out or do you find it exciting?
Love it. I really love it. It's a high energy thing and for Midday it was 1 hour. I don't think I would want to do like a morning program producer thing where that's like, 2.5, maybe 3 hours or whatever the morning drive might be. That might be a little much, but I really enjoyed my team. I was really engaged with the topic, so that helps. And it was a lot of fun to, especially for the programs where we had a lot of calls come in.
Yeah, right.
That was exciting to like screen them and make sure we have a good kind of cross section of the United States and represented and age groups represented and, yeah. and different perspectives represented. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you would you would be screening calls also during the program as it was airing as well?
Well, kind of the second screen, because the first screen, we have phone answerers who actually, they just answer as many calls as they can, and then they type in the information into our system. And then I do a second screen and decide which ones should go on the air and at which time, because they it might be a great comment, but we've moved on. Or maybe it could slide in a little later when we know we're going to talk about that particular thing. So,
Yeah, I've always wondered, too, with the call-in shows, if people ever call in and try to get past the screeners and then just say, like, whatever that they wanted or whatever little message or agenda that they wanted to put out there and misled screeners. Because that live element is really fascinating, and it tends to bring life to a show and energy. But I guess it could be a propaganda like tool as well. Did you ever find anything like that, or you pretty much didn't get those kind of calls?
Yeah, you know, a couple. You know, we had if ever a person did call in, they were flagged and they were never allowed on the air again. but yeah, you know, some people did get through. You know, they would say all the right Christian things like, "Oh, you know, I just heard what you said on the air, and I asked Jesus into my heart." And of course, it's like, wow, what a story.
That's how they got in?
That's the one they did that. Oh, yeah, it was terrible. So then when they got on the air, they had this big, like, political agenda. So, yeah, we put them off the air. But actually, you know, toward the end of my time there, we had a delay as well. So that helped if ever there was someone who got on who, I don't know, swore or said anything inappropriate, we could just wipe that out, and that never got aired.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. You will hear that once in a while. You'll hear someone and you're like, oh, they tricked a whole bunch of people.
Yes.
But the whole pulling Jesus, the stunt of you ask Jesus in your heart, I'm thinking that's gotta be like, that's wrong on a few levels, right?
Oh yeah!
Oh my gosh!
The lightning!
Not yeah. only did you not ask Jesus in your heart, you're nothing like him.
Right?
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, that was pretty bad. That actually, it was moments like that that really jaded me, you know, in the industry. And that's the sad part. It's like I generally, like, I love people. I find them interesting, and I believe the best in them right from the beginning. And so to be burned, that's like, hey, you know, I totally believe the best in you, and you just betrayed me.
Yeah, right. So. Just stabbed in the back. Well,
that's right.
And it's funny, too, because you could probably have like 500 awesome call-ins, and there's that one jerk that calls in, and you're like, that's it, you know, because it feels so powerful. And I just got a little hate mail this morning, and I tend to not get it. But this one guy somehow got a hold of my newsletter, which is fine. I put it out online, and you can read it if you want. And he's like, "How dare you shove your beliefs down people's throats?" And I'm thinking, really? I mean, you don't have to listen to or read anything I have. It's like, I thought it was very preachy, saying that I was preachy, which was really funny, because I think I was trying to do actually the opposite. I had a Muslim guy on the show, and obviously we don't have, our beliefs are not exact, but I felt that there was some common ground that I wanted to explore, and I wanted people to understand about his point of view. And, you know, Muslims aren't terrorists. There's a few of them out there, and then there's some really regular people. And so I don't know where he was coming from exactly, what religious, or maybe it was more of an irreligious thing, but that really bothered me. And I thought, I can't let that get headspace for free in my head, because there are so many people who are really enjoying what I'm doing, and and just, you know, there's at least four people. And well, those four people, those four people mean a whole lot to me. So so it was it's funny how that will really stick to you. There's a stickiness to that, like, negativity.
For sure. Yeah, sadly. Yeah, I've always admired people who could just kind of hear that negative feedback and just kind of, okay, shake it off and just stay committed to what they know that they're supposed to do. Even I don't know how I came across this. I watched just a brief documentary on Ellen DeGeneres and she, you know, she's such a positive person and a delight. I happen to be a big fan of hers. Like, not everyone agrees with her lifestyle and all that. But it's like, you know, what a lovely person who is pursuing peace and happiness and positivity in this world. And she said, you know, sometimes she gets hate mail and people don't like her, but she's like, oh, well, you know, how could people not like me? I like me, and and I can't not be me, and I can't not do what I feel like I should do. And I just thought, wow, and even as a believer, I should be solid like that in how I feel like God is directing me, or how I feel like He's equipped me to exist in this world. So why do I feel so shaky when people are negative?
I really like her humor. Even if you don't agree with her lifestyle choice, her humor is, I don't think, ever about that. And it's hilarious, self-deprecating humor that I just think is so funny. And I've loved her. And then when she came, it was kind of a very public thing when she came out as gay. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's going to change her humor. And it's going to be about that. And it really didn't seem to be at all, except for on the sitcom where they kind of did a big reveal. But as far as like her stand up and her show and stuff like that, it might come up, but it's super rare. And it's just not her shtick. You know, she does other stuff.
I have found her humor to be even more gentle and positive after she has come out. I saw a few of her stand-up routines early on in her career, and they were kind of sharp and a little more angry. And so now it just seems like she's softened a bit. I think she's always been delightful, but, you know, it just seems like she's more true. She just seems more settled in her skin. And I think that just makes anybody a more pleasant person to be around.
It really does depend on if you feel threatened. And if she was feeling threatened or insecure, that's the first thing on her mind. The second thing will be, you know, whatever message she's trying to get out. It's probably how it works. I mean, I'm in my early 40s, and I think, you know, my age is, you could tell I'm older and everything like that. But as far as like feeling settled in my own skin, I probably have never felt better about that. And it's really interesting. I mean, have you felt more comfortable in your skin in the last like 5 years or so? Is it plateaued or?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I think when I turned 40, I'm 41 now. When I turned 40, there was a big mind shift for me. In a lot of ways, it's like different things were just kind of falling into place in my life. And I think that was a real milestone for me, for just feeling more settled in who I am and feeling more confident. And I can actually say these days, I like who I am, and I'm happy being with myself. And that's not always been, it hasn't been the case for most of my life. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful state to be in, I think.
Yeah. I know I've read Anne Lamott quite a bit, and I really appreciate her writing. And she was talking a lot about, in the one book, I'm not sure if it's Traveling Mercies, I'm going to mess this part up, but she was talking about getting older and coming to a point where she kind of stopped caring so much about her looks. I mean, she had done a lot of tennis and been outside a lot, so she has a lot of skin damage and things like that, that, you know, more fair skinned and things. And she was talking about how, what a big deal her looks were to her at a certain point, and how much time and energy she spent thinking about it or hating herself for it or whatever. And then she just was like, hey, I'm older. I'm going to deal with it. And so is everybody else.
Mm. Yeah. And it was I like that.
It's like you hit a point where you're like, why am I trying so hard to please people that, you know, when I can't even just relax in myself? And I think that there must be a real gift to age in that way, that you can settle down and not let your insecurities and your worries kind of have the prominent headspace in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm thinking that is a gift of age that I'm really fine with that.
as soon as
it comes along, you know, every chance I get to more be able to more fully embrace that, I'm going to try to do that, because I've already found quite a bit of freedom in not in giving up some of the worry about, you know, like I think just your typical female stuff, like self-loathing of your body or comparing yourself to someone else or whatever it is, would in my 20s for sure took up way too much time, but I don't know that I knew a way around that yet.
Mm-hmm. Right. It seems like you kind of have to go through that to get to the other side. Mm. I don't know. At least that was my experience. And I think I got tired of it taking up so much of my mental energy. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you know, what about wrinkles and or whatever. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, it's everyone is going to age. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. So let's just move with it, mm-hmm. to not fight it so much.
Yeah. And it's funny too. I think the worst thing for me is seeing the commercials on TV that I feel like the last time I saw one, I was like, oh, that's right. They're reminding me that I'm supposed to be upset with how I look.
Oh, yes.
And I'm just supposed to defy my age, and I'm supposed to, and it's really interesting because that's, you know, that's how you sell products, of course.
Right.
But I was thinking, you know, the models that they're showing are under like 25 years old. And so, yeah, their skin's perfect pretty much.
Right. Yeah. You know, I have coffee with a friend, Michelle Van Loon. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She has written a few books. She's a wonderful writer. She wrote the book If Only. And she is working on another project where she's thinking a lot about aging and how in body image and how our society just values the 20 something body, face, hair, whatever, energy. Mm-hmm. And that demographic is so small compared to the reality of the rest of the world. So why are we all trying to like squeeze into these, you know, 5 years of our lives for our whole life, you know? And I loved how she framed that for me, because it really put it in perspective. It's like, this is a cultural thing that we value this one age bracket, but very few of us are still in it or are living it right now. So
yeah, absolutely. And we think that this is normal, but you know, there were powdered wigs when this country was founded, right? And having white hair was what you're supposed to have. That was the cool, wise look. I'm not sure exactly that I can figure out what all the powdered face and powdered wigs, but obviously that was to look older.
Yeah.
More pale and white haired. And if you didn't have white hair, you bought some. And it's just funny because we think of it as reality when it really is just a construct of culture.
Absolutely. And even for reasons that we maybe don't even know, like I was just talking to my mom this morning. She was watching a documentary about tuberculosis. Oh,
okay.
This is a little bit of a tangent. Yeah. And she said it, she found it fascinating that they didn't know at the time, and I can't remember exactly when this was, but they didn't know what was causing it. And they thought there for a while that, oh, it was dirt that was causing tuberculosis. So they raised women's dress hemlines because of that. And so that was the start of raising the hemlines.
Oh my goodness.
And so, you know, it was because of a health or a fear element that made this shift in a cultural norm for women.
Wow.
And I just think, wow, how many times can you repeat that for any sort of cultural image that we have taken on or accepted as, oh, this is how we should look now. How much of that is a reaction to fear or some sort of reason that we, you know, I don't know. It just, it's just kind of interesting to think about how we can unknowingly or unthinkingly just accept what our cultural norms are and not question them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when I was a little girl, I was just such a tomboy, and my mom would force me to wear dresses to church,
yeah.
right? And it was really important to wear a dress to church, and I felt so put upon, you know, like this is
yes.
the worst. And so my rebellious thing was wearing like knee socks and these like suede, I don't know if you remember, like back in the day, because we're similar age, like when people wore those suede like dress shoes, I don't know if you remember that, but there was this little blip in the fashion timeline. They looked ridiculous with any dress. I don't know what I was thinking, but this was my way of like, well, fine, but I'm not wearing dress shoes. I'm wearing knee socks and boyish dress shoes. and it's
great.
Like, and I don't even remember when people started wearing pants to my church. It was more conservative church, but there was definitely the idea that dresses are feminine, should be worn by women, men wear pants. But I was just thinking, you know, we have a lot of Amish around where we live. Actually, we're, you know, close to there. And when I see a woman in a dress, and I know they're wearing plain clothes to be modest and to wear, to not stand out, their, you know, homemade clothing, and sometimes they're all black or whatever. But they're just like anybody else at their church. So everybody looks pretty much the same depending on which church they go to. And I was thinking, actually, in some ways, it's less modest to wear a dress because someone might want to look up that dress. And it's actually maybe putting temptation in people's way that they did not anticipate when they came up with this, because it's so old fashioned that was modest at the time, but that now actually maybe it's more revealing what they're wearing than like pants. And it's just funny how that is. I know there was a group of Mennonite girls working on a missions project, and they had to wear what were essentially men's jeans underneath their dresses, because when they would go up the ladders to help with the roofing and the painting, you could see right up their dress.
Oh,
and none of the non-Mennonite girls had this problem because they were wearing just work clothes. And it was just funny. It was like, I'm sure that they didn't intend that they didn't intend this outfit
right.
to be less modest, right? But but there's this conformity issue and this cultural fashion, or it's not fashion, but you know, a cultural norm that you have to keep to, even if it stops making sense. And it's just it's remarkable. I guess it just helps to just be mindful of why are we doing this? You know, what is the point? Are we just following the rules? But why are the rules there anyway? And Well,
it's interesting.
We're going to be talking about friendships, and I don't know if you I'll probably wind up segmenting this a little bit because we've been talking about other things, but it's been really fun too. And I hate to leave people out, but when we were talking about talking about friendship, and I was kind of interested in hearing some of your thoughts about how your friendships have sort of gone through the years, how they've developed over the years, and what they've meant to you or not meant to you. I mean, that's kind of one of those gigantic questions, but I suppose you can, I guess I could start to tell you what I mean from my end, and then you can jump in with what your experience was. But so growing up, my family just really imploded, and that structure really wasn't there, really wasn't safe. And so in my teen years, when this was happening, my friends became everything to me. And the place of solace and rescue for me, and emotionally, but also spiritually, because I had close Christian friends. And I was so, God really put people in my life who were these just dear friends that I became so close to. But I think it was later I realized how much I needed them more than they probably needed me, because their life wasn't necessarily in a shambles as mine was. And, you know, how did that process develop for you when you were a teenager?
Well, let's see. For me as a teen, like in high school, well, I was homeschooled. Yeah. And I grew up out in the country with no neighbors, at least no neighbors with any kids my age. So, you know, I had a few friends who lived about 40 minutes away. And so we would try to get together every once in a while. But but honestly, I was a pretty lonely high schooler. But I'm also an introvert. So, you know, while I was lonely, I was like, you know, I like my space. This is good. And, you know, I have an older brother, and he really was a good friend of mine as I was in high school. And then as I went to college, I had a wonderful college roommate who really unknowingly taught me how to be a good friend and how to have a fight and still love each other.
Oh, that's what a great lesson.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So good. So good for me. And that was a hard, it was a hard lesson because I was always a runaway when there's conflict kind of person. Yeah. And so she made me stay and talk it out with her and reassure me that she was still going to be my friend. It was going to be okay, but we need to talk this out. And, yeah, so I gained some great, great lifelong friends in college. And I think it's been a little harder as I've been out of college. You know, I have, I think for, you know, working with Midday, finding friends has been one of the recurring themes that I would hear from listeners. How do I find friends? I'm so lonely, or I don't know. I just feel disconnected from the people that I know, and I don't feel like I have a good friend. And and so it seems like there's a lot of people who are lonely as adults and are looking for friends. And I think that's really something to look at, because we need each other so much. We're not meant to live in isolation, but that's so much of how our culture and our world, at least our American world, is made up of this individualism. And that's really troubling to me. And, you know, that's also my culture, and I'm an introvert still, and I love my space. And so, you know, finding friends and staying in touch with friends, that's still like something that I need to be really intentional about. And yeah, it kind of ebbs and flows too. You know, I think there are seasons with friends who kind of come and go.
Right. And I think that I have felt kind of guilty about that in the past, because I've felt like everybody, I really had the sense, and even until, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I really had the sense that while everybody I met wasn't going to be my absolute best friend, that I should probably be friends with everyone that I meet. And that when it didn't work out, I think I felt a little like something went terribly wrong, instead of just, well, that's not always going to be how it is. Or you might be friends with someone for like during a Bible study, and then after that, not. And that's not actually horrible or bad or anything. Is that it might just be a season. And I felt like that it was like something had gone wrong.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I don't think you're alone in that. I have felt that as well. Somehow that made me think too of a few, probably like, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago or so, I had an acquaintance who knew of a woman who lived in my community who was a Christian and who had just moved to the area, and she was lonely and wanted to meet some people in the community. And so our acquaintance said, you know, hey, let's set up a coffee for you two and you know, see if you hit it off. So so we went and we had coffee, and it was the most awkward experience ever. We had nothing in common. Oh. And we just like couldn't.
It was like a really bad date.
It really was. It really was. And it was so bad that the one thing we landed on that we did like was this particular TV show. I think it was House at that time. Uh-huh. And, you know, the medical show House. And we both realized that night was the latest episode of House. And we both, like half an hour into this really bad friendship date, we both decided, hey, it's on tonight. Should we just go and watch it? Go home and watch it. And we did. and so it's like, but I think we were both just relieved and it was okay. But I did wonder, wow, like what happened? Did I do something wrong there? Should I have been more open? But she didn't seem like she was all that excited to be there either. And so I've just like let it go that it's like, it's not meant to be. Mm-hmm. But I think it's hard to not take that personally or to think personally that, oh, I could have done something else, or there's something wrong with me that person doesn't want to hang out with me or whatever, because it's a vulnerable place to be, to put yourself out there for friendship. Yeah. And if you're rejected, it is like a bad date, I think, some ways.
Yeah, it is. Like, it's on an emotional level, I think, for sure, because especially if you're a kind of person that does feel like you connect with people. Like, if you feel like, I can get these good connections with people. And so then when you have a misconnection, it's like, what happened? But the funny thing is, I wonder if it was just too much pressure, because if you had just been doing a service project together and started talking and, you know, nothing had gelled, then you would have been like, whatever. But the fact that it was like, now we're going to have a friendly coffee.
Right.
And so there was a lot of like, this could be the start of something big. And it was like never going to work because it had this time bomb in it. And like in the end, it was just House, and the and House yet pulled you together, yet split you apart. Yeah.
So true.
Oh my gosh. So funny. Well, I remember before I had any kids, when I had the time to, I think it was a different situation. What happens, you know, when you have kids, you have friends that have kids, but you don't necessarily connect with them. Your kids are just friends. And I actually found that to be sometimes very disappointing. But before kids, you felt like you could connect more about other things. And sometimes that still happens. But I remember we were in this group of couples, and, this is a, you know, you'll be in a group with Bible study with couples from church or from your friend groups or something like that. And a certain amount of time went by, and I found myself like each time we were supposed to go thinking, oh no, because I felt like it was kind of not working anymore. And it was like not just breaking up with like one person, it was like breaking up with a bunch of couples. And it was like, we should go because, you know, of, you know, the camaraderie, and we're Christians, and we should go. And it was sort of like, I felt like I was going out of duty, and then I wasn't really connecting with anybody there, because it's not just necessarily connecting with one person. It's the couple. So it's like four relationships, you know? Yeah. Oh my goodness. That gets so tricky. And I don't know if you, with your husband, if you found that your friendships work out better if it's just you and the one other person, or do you have any couple friends where everything gels really well?
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to think, I don't know that we have, a group that we meet with from church. It's, I think we're at five families who get together once a week for, dinner. Mm-hmm. Not everyone can make it every time, but that's the group that's involved in that. And I think there are a few couples in that group that my husband and I love doing things with and hang out with. The bummer is several of the couples live pretty far away, and it's kind of a big deal to get together and, you know, do stuff with. And I'm actually really super okay with just, I'll hang out with my friends. My husband can hang out with his friends, but it's a really high value for my husband to have couple friends. And I don't know. I find that dynamic interesting. But we don't have any that we would say, like, you know, there are, Fred and Betty or whatever the Flintstone couple is.
We're going to have to totally find like a modern version of that. Would that be like Cam and Mitchell and Pepper? And no, I'm like, who would that be at this point? Because the Flintstones is going back pretty far, but I know that's what you mean. Far. Yeah. Like the two couples that do everything together, they go on cruises and they go on trips and everything like that. And because
the Monica Chandler,
that's still the 90s, Lori. Gosh,
Ross and Rachel,
yeah. Oh my gosh, but it's tricky with the personalities because I'm extroverted, but I'm married to, but not in my 20s. I felt much more like, hey, let's do a party, let's go out, and being married to such an introvert for so long, I learned from him, and I don't feel the need to, like, okay, let's have another great party. And I do get worn out by the things that used to enliven me. And so what's tricky though is that I like a mix of, like, okay, let's do some, I can do, even with people I really don't even like, I can do 90 minutes no problem, you know. And then but anybody that I want to spend more than 3 hours with, I can count on one hand for sure. And so just because of familiarity, but it's also maybe personality or worldview or whatever. And but my husband is very, very introverted, so he doesn't care if he even sees people until really recently, where he started doing cycling and meeting up with other men who cycle. And what it seems like for him, and maybe it's like this for your husband too, is like you do something and that's how the friendship builds. It's not like the friendship first and then you find things to do.
Right.
And and so I noticed that my husband, but a couple other men that I know, when I've mentioned, I'm not sure that I'm feeling that connected at church or whatever. And the one guy gave me advice, well, it's good if you do a service project together. And I thought, yeah, it is. But like, to me, a friendship is when you're not doing stuff and you're actually just talking about, you know, the tougher parts of life or the joys in life. And I think that might be just a male-female thing.
Could be. Though I have found that it does help me, and I have attributed this just to the introvertedness. I need a connecting point outside of myself to connect with friends, to just get involved in a club or some volunteer work. Mm-hmm. Like I've done improv classes, and I have a whole group of friends through that. And I don't know, different service projects or volunteering with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I have a great group of friends over there. And, you know, not super close friends, but like acquaintances. I really enjoy being around them and hanging out with them and just having friendly faces to see now and then. And I think for me, that's a help to have some sort of central focus outside of myself to start with.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think it's like it takes the pressure off if you have something bigger that you're both sort of working on or involved with. So I totally get that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's it doesn't have like, well, that maybe that's why the coffee thing didn't work out.
Yeah. right. It's like,
because it's sort of it's a stand-in. So if the conversation gets dull, I mean, you always have something that you're involved with. But I'm really interested about the improv. So are there like videos out there of you? Like, What is it? I'm intrigued now.
Well, I have a friend of mine was going through a really difficult time of transition, and he was taking an improv class. And so he was trying to recruit his friends to join him. And so I was like, yeah, I've always wanted to just try that. Wow. Just, I love being silly and I love laughing. So he roped me into, it's just a community college close to me. And it was the most fun I think I've ever had. We just laughed for 2 hours straight and just so much fun. And so it's just I'm no longer taking classes, but I took three classes, and then I get together now monthly with a group of friends who just do improv in each other's homes. And we just, sometimes we'll go out and watch improv. We just went to a show this last, 2 weeks ago, together. And it's fun because we can watch and then we chit chat afterwards and kind of evaluate how the performer, how the comedians did. And, it has been really, really good for me to not take myself so seriously. Yeah. It helps me to that end. Yeah. Because when you do improv, you're expected to be foolish and silly and really over the top. And it is such an outlet for me for creativity, and I can bring in the diverse things that I'm interested in to whatever sketch I'm doing. And it's a very physical activity too. So I'm running around, and it has been a surprisingly really beautiful element in my life, and I'm really thankful for it. It's been great.
Well, yeah, as you describe it, it gets less surprising then, because what's great about improv is that it gives you license in a safe environment, in a non-threatening environment, to let yourself loose. It's a permission slip. So that makes perfect sense.
Exactly.
I was listening to someone. I'm not sure if it was Amy Poehler or if it was just someone speaking about improv and mentioning Amy Poehler and her book. I think it's called Yes, Please or something. And what they were talking about was the life lesson that improv is and how to relate with other people. Because instead of saying no and giving resistance or rebuffing someone in some way, in any way, in improv, you say yes and.
Yes and, yeah.
And that yes and in regular life is life-giving and helps you negotiate. It helps people feel accepted and loved. It helps people feel like their ideas matter and that they matter. And that just having a yes and attitude could solve all kinds of conflicts. And I really took that to heart. And I started thinking about that in terms of, instead of thinking about, you have this position, I have this position, we're different. You can say of someone's position or somebody's point of view, kind of like, I see you and here's something else. It's not in opposition to you, but I'm going to add to that a little bit. I'm not going to invalidate anything that you're thinking, feeling, or saying. I'm just going to add to it. And then you can add to what I'm going to say. And I thought, what a fantastic social, I mean, I don't even know what you'd call it. A way to be social with each other in a way that everybody wins.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. And it just seems like a more open, it's a little more just going with life, as it comes, and like being true to who you are, but it's not this constant, like, I'm not a brick wall to every new idea that comes to me. Instead, it's like, I just want to be like an ocean or something, and just be more open and, a learner to whatever comes my way. And there's a lot to the yes and the other life lesson I really gained was, had to do with teamwork, because there's sometimes with a team of improv performers or whatever you call them, you have a great idea. They call it the spark. You have the spark of the great idea of where you want to take a skit. But if someone else comes along and they have an idea and they take the skit a different direction, you have to let that go. Ooh. And just, you know, and acquiesce to the other team member. And I found that to be really hard. Oh. And, you know, to submit to the other person's brilliant idea and then work to make their idea the best possible idea that there is. And I thought, wow, there's a lot to that too.
Oh my goodness.
You know, to giving up my own desires for the sake of the team and for sake of the sake of this bigger product that we want to offer the world.
Yeah. And it's a lot to it. It's like you take your ego and you just let it go. You just say, okay, I'm not going to care enough that this is going to like hurt my feelings or ruin my day. I'm going to just be part of the team. That is a big, I don't know if you could learn that another way in a different environment that wouldn't be threatening. Like, that's really interesting.
Right.
Do people get offended a lot in improv then later when you're debriefing? Or they be like, hey, I didn't like when you did that? Or is it pretty much like, hey, whatever, we all had fun? Or
You know, I think it's you know, it's all for the sake of fun and creativity. And I think a good team of performers, you trust each other and you just trust that spark, that idea that I had, it was a good idea, but it'll come back around another time when I can use it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's that free flowing. It's the yes and, concept. And, and so actually we didn't have a lot of people who were offended. There were some people that I enjoy, working with more than others because I trust them and I kind of know how they think. Mm. And so I kind of know where they're going to go with a skit. And others, I think, wow, that was really random. And I have no idea. I have no idea where you're going with that, but I'll follow.
Well, it's funny what you say because, you know, and I don't know if you ever watched the show The Office when it was on and Steve Carell.
Oh,
And he's from an improv background. And so are a lot of the people on that show. Mm-hmm. And what was so funny is that, like, they spoofed the person who's bad at improv. And I don't know if you remember this, but they had, you know, Michael Scott, who's has to be the funniest, or he gets really upset if he's not the funniest and he has to be the most talented. Yeah. So he's in an improv. And I don't know if you remember this. Every single improv, he'd shoot everyone and kill them all. Do you remember this?
No.
Oh my gosh. It was so funny. They're like, you did it again. You killed everyone. Because he had to take control of the group, and when they didn't, he just suddenly pull a gun and shoot them.
Yeah.
And they'd have to die because they have to do it. And they were getting really ticked off because, like, this was in a short amount of time. It was like three different sketches, and all three within like 5 minutes, he'd killed people again. It was not being flexible. He was not working with anyone as a team, and they were getting so sick of the falling over and dying. He's like, you're dead, remember? And it was just such a great picture of like, no, I have to be the funniest and I'm going to control this. And you all have to play by these rules that you decided. It was just such a, it was just such a great picture of someone who couldn't handle it, like maturity wise.
Oh, that's funny. I must have missed that episode. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, now that we live in a time where you can just look anything up like that up
I'll be doing that.
Yeah. But it was great. And it made me, you know, it's funny because when, like I was mentioning, developing into more introversion over the years, and improv would have been something that I would have loved to have done. And I've gotten more insecure about doing stuff like that. I know I would have to like work those muscles out again. And, and it's funny how you can kind of, close off to that, I think.
I think it's pretty vulnerable, I think. And I still have times when I'm with my group, I think, I can get up there and I'm just going to draw a blank and then everyone's going to be disappointed. You know, and they used to say I was funny. And so I think it is, you know, there is some vulnerability with it that can be scary, but I think the more you can just go with the process and just be loose and comfortable, it really does come. You know, we have a well to draw on, a well of experience and thinking, and and I think that that's another life thing too. You know, if we can just not be so tense and tight as we walk through life. Mm. We have so much, a wealth to draw on mm. in our life experience that we can bring to the table today. Mm. But when we're so tight, at least for me, I kind of, you know what I mean by that, just mm-hmm. like internally this tense sort of kind of a fearful response. Mm-hmm. For me, that blocks off so much of my creativity and my ability to be present mm-hmm. and fully alive where I am. So the more I can just relax and not take myself as seriously, and mm-hmm. I can just show up and be present and just be me and be, like we were saying before, just comfortable in my own skin.
Yeah. And maybe that's the biggest lesson of friendship for sort of this episode, is that, you know, if you're going to be have this sort of improv mindset to you, or sort of orientation to how you're going to see friendship, it really is going to take two people to do that, because the one person being shut off isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. But if if two people are basically like, yeah, we don't know how this is going to go, we might feel this is risky, this friendship and getting to know each other past a superficial level feels risky, but we're going to both work with it and think of it almost as improv. And you know, the idea of thinking of things as play is another aspect that, like, are we all serious here, or is there time to play? And I might misspeak and say the wrong thing as I'm getting to know you as a friend, and maybe, you know, maybe we'll have a disagreement or something, but that we can still roll with it and just continue those relationships in a freer place.
Yeah. Oh. I like that.
Mm-hmm. we could probably wrap it up, because looking at my power strip and it's I'm going to get into single digits on my power. I wind up having to unplug my computer when I record, because I'll get like a hum in it that I have to take out later. One day when I get a big humanities medal for my work, like Krista Tippett, yeah, I will have a studio where this was not be a problem. But right now I look carefully at my power, like my little battery bar, and I'm like, this is always fun to speak with you, because you draw from a well of experience and a lot of reading and a lot of different influences that make the conversations that we have, but also the conversations I've observed that you've had over the years, they're very flavorful. And that's why it's such a treat to talk with people like you who've been through things. It's not, you know, you're more in touch with your feelings, you're more open to risk, and it's just really a joy to have these conversations.
Well, thank you. Thanks. I've really enjoyed this as well. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun talking to you.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe in a few more weeks, maybe we can join up again and see what the next thing is we could talk about. And
That sounds great. Always up for it.
Well, thank you so much, Lori. And I hope you continue to enjoy your visit in Ohio. And I will let you know all the latest scoop of whenever this goes up, probably in about 4 weeks or so.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great.
And,
all right.
And we'll both have to remember to do the yes and in all our relationships.
Right.
That's our takeaway nugget.
Yes, that's the homework.
Very good. Yeah. Absolutely. Did you know that every episode of Spark My Muse has show notes? You can find show notes at sparkmymuse.com, and in those show notes you'll find details about the people, books, and resources that were mentioned in the show. And sometimes you'll find photos and embedded videos too. I hope you'll stop by and check it out.